You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The words of Malcolm X, now over 65 years after his assassination, have never loomed larger in our national conversation. Those words demanding equity and respect now, and equal treatment in economics, housing, and justice are at the heart of our conversations on confronting systemic racism and movements like Black Lives Matter here in the U.S. and in other racial justice movements around the world, Europe, Asia, and elsewhere. For nearly 30 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, editor, and Newsday syndicated columnist Les Payne, aided by his daughter, principal researcher Tamara Payne, interviewed family members of Malcolm, associates, and adversaries, reviewed government documents and his speeches and writing to best know this man, arguably more influential today than at the time of his death in February 1965. The result is this past year's National Book Award-winning nonfiction book, The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. Sadly, Les Payne did not live to finish his magnum opus. That fell to his daughter, Tamara, who finished the book and joins us today to talk about Malcolm X, today on Studio Tulsa. Tamara Payne, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
Your father, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Les Payne, worked on this project for many, many years, and you worked alongside him as the principal researcher, and in fact, he unfortunately passed before he could publish this book. What did he want readers to know about Malcolm X?
Really, it was a book to look at Malcolm in the context of his family and who he was as a person, to see what he was like as a child, and also to look at him in the context of his family and the context of the world that he was born into.
One of the things I found very interesting about this book is that you spend a lot of time on his childhood and his family life, even prior to him being born. I think it's one of this book does is help us understand those key moments of Malcolm's life, and one of those is his family. The Little family was quite remarkable for their time. They were adherent to Marcus Garvey's philosophies, which saw them take very bold and some would say sometimes foolhardy risk for the time. What do we need to know about Malcolm's family that helped shape him?
I think it's important to understand that his mother, Louise, who came from Grenada, his father was born in Georgia. There's a lineage here. You know, it goes beyond just who we see Malcolm being in the 20th century. So what we really look into is, you know, when Louise and Earl Little come together at that Marcus Garvey meeting in Montreal, and they're attracted to each other, and they get married eventually, and they settle in Philadelphia and start their family. And under the tenets of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, and they were followers of his organization, and it is these tenets that held them together and how they raised their family and their children. Earl Little had a very strong work ethic. He was very charismatic. He wasn't shy. He could talk with people. And Malcolm got to see that when he would take Malcolm to meetings, you know, during his organizing days when they were in Lansing, even. And Louise, their mother, she just really taught the principles of Garveyism, but not just the principles of Garveyism. Let's understand what Garveyism is. It's about Black pride, being independent-minded, supporting your community and building your community and building your own businesses and supporting them. And this is, you know, in a time in the 1920s, during a time when there's a lot of actions moving against Black people who are trying to rise up and thrive. And so she's instilling in them, you know, through these teachings, you know, in her children about being proud to be Black, embracing who they are as Black people, in spite of what other people in society, whether it's their teachers and their white classmates might say to them. So this is that grounding, and is this grounding of who Malcolm is as a Black person and a Black man and his siblings, all of his siblings carried this throughout their lives, that Malcolm has in his childhood, and it's not something that he just picked up from Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam.
Right. You recount episodes even before Malcolm was born of them being in Omaha during the race riot there, and his mother Earl was out, his mother faces off, you know, you have to assume because of their philosophy, they would be a target in a situation like this. And she faces off a white gang at her doorstep. So these were, they were incredibly brave. And as you mentioned, Earl was an eloquent preacher and organizer. And he would move his family into white neighborhoods in the teens and 20s, which was, you know, that was an incredibly brave decision. And, you know, actually they took bold risk, and it actually, a lot of times it hurt their family.
Yeah, it did hurt their family, but it also continued to build that character of standing up for what they believe in and who they are against what people would want them to believe and bow down to the pressures, you know, of white supremacy. And I just want to also make it clear that there was a race riot in Omaha, Nebraska in 1919. The Little family was not there. They moved a couple of years after. But that famous riot, I mean, when they moved there, they were still, that town, Omaha, was still feeling the reverberations from that incident. And so that's why it's just important to, you know, account for the attitudes that prevailed at that time. And this race riot is the Omaha incident of 1919, and is also known as the Will Brown lynching. The lynching of Will Brown, a woman claims that she was raped, and they pick out Will Brown, and eventually, you know, they don't give him a trial, but they lynch him for that. And then later it's found, you know, years later that this was not true, that this woman was not raped, and that Will Brown the extent that this mob mentality went after Will Brown, who was one person, one black man, you know, with rheumatoid arthritis. And they hung him, they shot his body, they dragged him through the streets, and then they burned him.
Yeah. Well, we all here in Tulsa are all well too familiar with stories like that in our history. Mm-hmm. But what you see out of this is that this is just an unrelenting courage to stand up for your rights, to be acknowledged as equal in every regard, and that seeped down mm-hmm. to Malcolm.
Yep, and all of his siblings. And then when we even later on talk about Malcolm when he joins the Nation of Islam, it is through his family. It's Wilford who joins the Nation of Islam, and he's attracted to the Nation of Islam because of their Garveyite leanings. Elijah Muhammad didn't preach Garveyism, but he did have his own teachings. And so he had his own teachings, but he also that was similar to Garveyism, and it was using Garveyism. Garveyism was kind of more the undertow in the Nation of Islam's philosophy, and Wilford was attracted to that. Because, again, it's about building their community. They built their businesses. They wanted their own schools to educate their children. And Wilford is attracted to that, and he brought in all of his siblings. And Malcolm at that time was in jail. He was in his 20s serving time for his crime ring activities in Boston. And Wilford, you know, we had his brothers go out and talk to Malcolm and made him join. And part of joining is, you know, he had to change. He had to get out of his mindset, you know, but Malcolm was already moving out of the mindset of being a criminal and being, you know, so confrontational physically, and was moving to more of the intellectual confrontations, you know, where he was debating. He was reading everything he could read. He was expanding his mind. He was even learning how meditating, and he was doing all these things through people that he met in jail, like Bembry. And Malcolm Jarvis, who was his buddy from Boston, was also going through these activities with him. But it was the family that brought Malcolm into the Nation of Islam because they had joined it. And when he got out of jail, he was able to pivot into you know, important roles where he could be a recruiter. And then he kind of went up through the ranks because he was smart, he was a fast learner, and he was determined. And he agreed, and it resonated with him.
One of the disputed points of Malcolm X's life from previous biographies and his autobiography is just how deeply into criminal activity he was and how important this incarceration time was in his life arc, if you will. The autobiography and some other biographers have disagreed Your father, in your account, says while he wasn't necessarily violent, he was deeply involved with criminal elements. How important was this incarceration to his arc of his life?
Well, I think it really shows him. You know, it's another example of how this country treats anybody. You know, how this country is working, and particularly how it treats Black people.
Yeah, how it treats people of color. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, this country, you know, we talk about people of color, but this country really has really worked against Black people and made laws against Black people. They didn't say that Puerto Ricans couldn't own land. They said Black people couldn't own land.
True.
I mean, there's a distinction here, and there's a long history of it. So, you know, and this incarceration really showed him getting that jail time. Even he had to say that this is a long period, long time for the crimes that we've committed, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, even he had to say that. So it really teaches him that. And it also, it's the thing that it forces him to slow down. It forces him to rethink what he's doing because he's not listening to people. His family wasn't able to reach out to him. And so it makes him pivot. And then he does. He's able to pivot. Some people, they can have that happen to them and not do that. When what? They come out, they go back. But he did not. He had a support system that helped him.
My guest today is Tamara Payne. She is the principal researcher with her late father, Les Payne, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, on their final book, which they collaborated on, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction, The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tell us a little bit about the process of the book, because you and Les worked on this for 30 years. Why did it take so long to complete? And one of the things that's obvious is he and you interviewed anybody and everybody that was connected to Malcolm X's life.
Well, at least anybody and everybody we could find. There's a difference. Look, Dad, when he met the two brothers in Detroit, he met one at first and then he heard this story, and there was that great story. It's like he meets one brother, he hears the story, he comes back to New York and talks with his colleague, Gil Noble, who also is an important journalist here in New York, who tells him, which brother did you speak to? He says, the brother you should speak to is Wilfred. So Dad said, I didn't speak to Wilfred. He goes back. He spoke to Philbert first, and then he goes back to and he interviews Wilfred, who's Malcolm's oldest brother, who's by 6 years, and he's also Malcolm's confidant and best friend. So Dad got to hear another side of Malcolm, and it was just fascinating to Dad. He said, we don't know this. This is important to understand who Malcolm was. Dad was inspired by Malcolm. He went to see Malcolm himself in Hartford in 1963, and, you know, and that even changed him. You know, we go into that in the book of how Malcolm, you know, impacted my father in dealing with what we're calling the false sense of inferiority that Black people in this country face in dealing with white supremacy and racism. And so what Dad wants to know is, well, who is this person that impacted? You know, not just him, but so many people. And the other thing is young people keep picking up Malcolm. Malcolm, even though he died in 1965, he never left the stage. Nobody right. forgot him. In fact, he just became even larger than life. I mean, people in England, people in India were picking him up. People in the Middle East were picking him up, and they still talk about Malcolm. So, I mean, he's huge. And so Dad wants to know, well, who is this person? He thought we knew everything. We had everything we needed to know from his autobiography. But after talking to the brothers, he realized there's much more to him beneath the surface. And what I think is also wonderful about this book is that my father himself, who grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, he was born there, and that's in Jim Crow South. And then his family moves up to Hartford, Connecticut. And we have, you know, parts of the story that take place in Hartford that are important to Malcolm's story, at least in this book. But Dad was able to tell those stories. And what's important is that Dad's experiences of growing up in Jim Crow South, growing up also in Hartford, going to college, he also served in the military. And then he goes into journalism, rises up to the ranks of journalism. All those experiences form you know, his mechanism of how he processes all this information. And so what we're getting is from this person who's also gone through some of these experiences firsthand and kind of pushing forth this information of what's important, because he's telling it, he's getting more of a sense of what was happening in real time because he too experienced a lot of that.
Right. You mentioned Hartford, where your father lived, and tell us about that Hartford part of the story and Rosalie Glover.
That's a beautiful story in the sense that Dad was fascinated to find out that Malcolm, you know, but he organized the Hartford chapter for, you know, this for the Nation of Islam. And just to also make it clear, Malcolm was always operating as, you know, a member of the Nation of Islam. He was not the leader of the group. He was national spokesperson. He may have become the face of it because of dealing with the media and stuff, but Elijah Muhammad was always the leader. So he, all his actions, he had to go back and get approval from Elijah Muhammad. And so Rosalie Glover is in Hartford. She's from Florida. She leaves Florida because, like we were talking about, the lynching of Will Brown, she experiences a lynching. And not her, but she of a young neighbor. And she just could not raise her children in that environment. She had raised some, and they were older, but she had young children. She did not want to continue with that. So she moved up north, and again, she was searching for how do we survive but connect and build our community. And she also was, you know, part of the Moorish Science Temple there, and she didn't really like how that was playing out. And she had listened to Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, and that resonated with her. So she reached out to Malcolm. She went to one of his meetings in another town, Springfield, and she asked him if he would come to Hartford, her apartment, and he agreed. And that's what starts. And what's wonderful about this story is that, you know, even though, yes, Malcolm has had the permission to start this temple in Hartford, we get to see Malcolm interact with these members, these founding members in Hartford, more independently. He's not surrounded by the whole culture and the hierarchy of the Nation of Islam, and this is in the late 50s, early 60s. So he's not surrounded by all of that. So he kind of is like how Malcolm would operate as a leader, without, you know, outside of the nation almost. You know, even though he's carrying on the nation's teachings and he agrees with them. So he's very strong with it, but just how he interacts with the people, how he listens to them. He's a great listener, how he helps them to realize certain things, how he gets them to move from being complacent to taking more action and building up the community and starting their businesses and pushing forward even to purchasing getting the building to house the temple, which is still standing now in Hartford, Connecticut. It's moved, but it's still in existence today.
You recount a remarkable meeting that Elijah Muhammad sent Malcolm to meet with the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan in, I think it was in 1961. Why and what was the reason for this meeting?
I mean, I think it's important to also look at what is going on in Georgia. This was in Georgia. It took place in Atlanta. There's a temple down there that Malcolm was visiting in Atlanta that the minister Jeremiah at that time, he later was known as Jeremiah Shabazz, had invited Malcolm, and Malcolm was giving a sermon. And while doing this, during the sermon, they receive a telegram from the local chapter of the Klan, and they say that they would like to have a meeting with them. And so, again, they're not the leaders. They go back to Chicago, meet with Elijah Muhammad, show him the telegram, and they discuss this. Malcolm, you know, his idea was he wants to have a confrontation. He doesn't have a good taste in his mouth about the Klan for good reason.
Yeah.
With the opening of the book, but also because of his belief, you know, that the Klan killed his father. We showed that they did not, you know, in Lansing. However, that was his belief, and we can talk later about why he believed that. But he carried that to the end of his, you know, to his dying day. And so he didn't want to have any kind of alliance with the Klan. He wanted to have more of a confrontation. Elijah Muhammad did not. Jeremiah Shabazz, you know, he's a soldier. So he was, whatever, you know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wants, that's what we're going to do. But Malcolm, you know, in the way he was dealing and where he's coming from, he always kind of wants to have an impact and an influence. That's why he's able to rise up through the ranks of the nation the way he does, because he just moves at that level. And so he wants to have an impact on this meeting. Elijah Muhammad is looking at this because he wants to promote what he wants to do in the South, which is he wants to build up more temples, he wants to get land, he wants to set up a separate state, he wants to have farms, he wants so that they can have their own, you know, independent industries with farming and developing their own food and stores and all that. And so he says, well, maybe we can work something out. Maybe we can see what we can get. We want land. Maybe they can help us get this. If they can't help us with obtaining this land, then maybe they can help us by not harassing our members. And that's major for Elijah Muhammad. That's what, you know, he's looking at this to do. And Malcolm, you know, he doesn't want to do that. That's not, he feels that any kind of alliance or relationship with the Klan is an unholy alliance. And so he doesn't want to do that, but he doesn't want to leave, not, you know, he doesn't want to be, not be part of the meeting, because he wants to be able to impact this meeting so that it's not that the nation comes out with the short end of the stick. So he goes to the meeting and, you know, they have their talk to hear what they have to say. And then what comes out of that meeting is really interesting, and getting the details of this meeting and is really great. And interesting how we got the details of the meeting. We got it from Jeremiah Shabazz, and he gives us, you know, really what happened, what the language was, what the Klan was thinking at that time, and what, you know, was important to them. And then he talks about how Malcolm, you know, acted and you know, and what, you know, and how he had influenced the meeting. But, you know, it's really interesting to say this. And what's great about this is just kind of an example of real journalism, in the sense that, you know, there's this saying, if my dad would say, it's like, a journalist should never say, we may never know. It is our job to find out.
Right.
What he did is we found out what happened in that meeting. And that's important. This book is really, Dad is a journalist to his core. And in telling this story that of a Malcolm who was influenced by his family and born into the world that he's born in, what that world was like, which was not different from the world that my father experienced, you know, from birth, he wants to tell that story, but he also wants to tell the most accurate story he can tell and prove.
My guest today is Tamara Payne, a principal researcher with her late father, Les Payne, on their final book, which won the National Book Award, The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, this meeting, you write that this was perhaps one of the first, well, maybe not the first, but a major point in Malcolm's life where he is becoming disillusioned with the leadership of the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad. And eventually, mm-hmm. as time went on, both Elijah Muhammad was and his sons were worried about Malcolm because of his great charisma. There's another section of the book in which you and your father talk about the similarities and differences between Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in how they approached audiences, how they spoke to audiences. It's a wonderful, wonderful section. And of course, you detailed the break with the Nation of Islam. And you know, the idea I always had about Malcolm's break was it was partly Elijah Muhammad, but it was also Malcolm's being exposed to Sunniism. And I always thought it was when he finally went to Mecca, but this book opened my eyes to this story is far more complex. We may not have time to go into the whole thing, but what changed about Malcolm in his eyes about the Nation of Islam?
He thought it was a great organization, even to the day he died. He talked about it was a great organization, but there are things about it that when he became disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad, and that really tore him apart, because, you know, Malcolm, in one sense, he was very close to his father. And when his father died, that was huge in his life. And he kind of wandered and, you know, he got into some trouble because he's also always this searching for that kind of somebody to help him fulfill that void that his father had filled in his life. And so Elijah Muhammad kind of filled that void for him. So to lose him, to lose this kind of figure again was heart-wrenching to Malcolm. I mean, it was a very difficult decision for him to leave. But he also was thinking, and when he he was thinking also about the organization too. He wanted the organization because he believed that it was still a good organization and that it should continue. And if his presence in it was going to continue to make it, you know, dysfunctional and in this building environment, you know, that was against him, was going to be a distraction from the work that they were trying to do. I mean, it was better for him to get out, also for his own safety, you know, which he turned out, you know, that didn't help either.
Right. In fact, you in writing about his assassination, Elijah Muhammad ordered it, and perhaps the government had a role.
I wouldn't say perhaps. I wouldn't. I would say that it's pretty clear they were involved.
Oh.
Because you have to understand, the Nation of Islam was infiltrated. It was tapped and electronically surveilled by the government, so they knew, and Hoover felt that the Nation of Islam, as well as Martin Luther King were, and Malcolm X were, threats to the American society. And so he wanted to diminish their, you know, their threats. So he infiltrated them and to weaken them and to and really pushed apart. You know, he actually pushed further this split between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. And, you know, as he did similarly with Martin Luther King. And so when you're doing that and you're creating this environment, paranoia, and people don't trust each other, who used to trust each other, who once admired Malcolm, but now they want to say that Malcolm is the selfish person, they're creating this environment. And this is being done by people who have been infiltrated and are being provocative. And so that's why I would say that I wouldn't say perhaps. They were definitely, their hand is in there. And their hand is in there when you have informants who are reporting that Malcolm's assassinated to their supervisors. We have it on the scene that there are FBI informants there in the room, in the Audubon, as well as we have a Bossy agent, who Gene Roberts. He's an undercover agent for Bossy, which is a part of the New York Police Department, but he was not a police officer.
Hmm.
He was an agent and on the security team for Malcolm. I mean, I want to also kind of put in a little bit what my father would talk about. And he talks about both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in this light about, you know, what you need in a leader of oppressed people. You know, you need somebody who is smart. You need somebody who has good judgment. You need somebody who is courageous. And you need somebody who is selfless. And both of them have these characteristics. And when you have these characteristics, that's why you see Malcolm, he wasn't thinking of himself. He wasn't even thinking about his family at that point. He had no insurance for his family. His family was bombed out of their house
right, by
the Nation. We talk about that in the book. And that was a week before he was killed. But yet he was still doing his work of working on freeing, you know, of the freedom of black people in America, and wanting to continue with his work of bringing charges against the United States for violating the human rights of black people in America.
The dead are rising. Tamara Payne, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Tamara Payne was the principal researcher with her father, Les Payne, on their final collaboration, the book which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2020, The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Thanks for listening.